When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is First Draft, a dialogue on writing. I'm Mitzi Rapkin. This is a show about craft, the writing life, and the themes that are present in a writer's work. Every interview is a journey. I don't really know where our conversation is going to go, but I do know that it's fascinating every time, and one way or another, we seem to get around to what it means to be human and how through craft, that idea is articulated on the page. Thank you for joining me on this literary pilgrimage into the mind of one writer at a time. My interview today is with Sloane Crosley, author of the memoir Grief is for People.
The trick, hopefully, of this book is to make it seem like all of it just poured out of me in one go. Do you know, the trick is to make it look like I almost can't help myself but say certain things, because that's how it felt in the moment.
We'll be back with Sloane Crosley after these essential words. Here's what I want to say about pitching for patrons. It's my least favorite thing to do, but it supports my most favorite thing to do. Share this podcast with the world and with you. And so I'm wondering, do you get something out of this? Do you listen more than 8 times a year? Is there something of value for you in these episodes? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then why not support this content by becoming a patron of First Draft? You can do that at patreon.com/firstdraftwriters. Here's the common conversation I have at parties. Okay, I don't really go to parties because I'm always doing this, but this is a common conversation I have about this podcast. So why did you start this? Someone asks. I don't really know. I was a radio reporter for years and getting my MFA in fiction, and I missed interviewing people. So I combined these two things and started this show. I didn't really think about what I was doing. I didn't have a master plan. It just seemed like a fun idea at the time. And I still don't really have a master plan, but it's been 10 years that I've been doing this. So then they asked, do you make money? And the answer is, I have some incredible patrons, but they come and go. And lately, for whatever reason, and this is really vulnerable here, more people have left than joined. I can't pretend to know why, but in exit surveys, they usually say it's for financial reasons and that they really love the content. And I get that. I really get it, because there are expenses to make this podcast and financial needs to make this podcast. I will say that every hour I'm working on this is time I'm not spending at a quote-unquote paying gig. Times have changed since we got our newspapers on our stoops twice a day. You know that. Our content comes from all over the place. But in this case, there isn't an AI behind this, just an I, which is me, Mitzi, all by my lonesome, doing the research, booking the guests, reading their work, conducting the interview, uploading it into the podcast world, and then doing it again and again and again, more than 50 times in the last year. I produce one episode a week, and that is on top of all my other jobs, which is why I don't go to parties or really do anything on the weekends except for this. So if you value this podcast, please consider supporting it with a financial contribution. Membership starts at $6 a month and includes extras like writing tips, cuts that didn't make it into the final show, end of the year thank you gifts, ad-free, pitch-free episodes so you won't have to hear this again, and more. I think in this world, we have to support what we love, and there is an energy there that comes back to us. So please go to patreon.com/firstdraftwriters and become a supporter of First Draft today. It still doesn't make a shred of sense that I'm doing this podcast. Still, here I am after a decade. But Rumi said, set your life on fire. Seek those who fan your flames. So I'm inviting you to warm yourself by this fire and bring your fan along. Patreon.com/firstdraftwriters. And on to the show. My guest today is Sloane Crosley, author of the New York Times bestselling essay collections, I Was Told There'd Be Cake, How Did You Get This Number, and Look Alive Out There. Her novels include The Clasp and Cult Classic. She served as editor of the Best American Travel Writing Series and is a former book publicist. She is currently a contributing editor at Vanity Fair. Her new memoir, Grief is for People, is about two losses that shake Crosley to her core that occur within a month of each other. The first is a random break-in to her apartment that results in some of her most prized possessions and family heirloom jewels being stolen. The second and more severe loss occurs 1 month later with the suicide of her best friend and one-time boss named Russell. Crosley looks for answers in philosophy, friendship, art, and her own history to find a framework for her grief. Crosley and Russell worked together in book publishing, but became best friends and stayed close even when she left the job where they met. Grief is for People offers a view into Crosley's mourning process, which at its heart acknowledges the unfathomability of severe loss and how to reckon with acceptance. We began the interview with me asking Sloane Crosley if it is hard to talk about her loss.
I'm not great at compartmentalization. I need to get better at it because I do think that I can almost feel a, for lack of a more grounded term, a sort of mantra coming on of I am not the book and Russell is not the book, you know, and try to remember that both when good and bad things happen or, you know, there's a sort of array of reactions, which so far have been truly overwhelmingly emotional and touching and positive, but you know, the book hasn't come out yet. So I don't really know if it's hard to talk about the book in a context like this with someone who's interviewing me, who's read it, who's used to interviewing authors, who's used to talking about, you know, a variety of human experience with a variety of humans. I think that it's going to be different at readings and going on book tour, but in some ways, I mean, I'm looking forward to that. And I've had an inadvertent training camp, I suppose, in having three books of humor essays and people share their stories that mirror mine when they see me. And it's just that I think will be a little bit more upsetting this time.
Did you think when you were writing this about what Russell would think of you writing this book from two lenses, both as your very good friend and also as someone who would have to publicize it later?
Well, I'll answer that backwards. So he, you know, he worked for Knopf and Vintage, and the book is FSG, so he would not have to publicize it unless something went very wrong at both publishing houses, I suppose. I did think about him reading it, especially in the last section of the book where the voice sort of changes and I speak to him directly, and it is meant to feel like you're eavesdropping on a conversation a little bit more than you have been already for the preceding, you know, 100 or so pages. But I think that fundamental to the question is the assumption that he would read it, and he might not. He read a few of my essays. I don't think he read my novel. He didn't read most of what I wrote. And he loved me very much. I think he did this because he also had difficulty compartmentalizing, and he had a lot of passion for his friends, a lot of whom were writers, and he would hire writers. I'm not the only one. He also hired, which is strange for a book publicity department as opposed to an editorial department. Most book publicists don't necessarily have a secret novel underneath the table, or that's not like the trope, but we did. So he hired Hanya Yanagihara, of course, who wrote A Little Life, Ethan Rutherford, who had some stories in Best American and also a story collection. I think he might have two. Sorry, Ethan, if you're listening. Paul Yoon, and then a bunch of people who sort of did writing on the side. And so I feel like he had to sort of make the separation where he often wouldn't read our work. And I think the only reason he actually read A Little Life is because he did have to publicize it. But I think your actual question is less logistical and probably more, what would he feel emotionally if he read it? And, you know, this is someone who obviously, at least towards the end, had a sort of vested interest in some sort of self-erasure, right? We can say that the minimum that we can say about someone who dies by suicide. So I think he probably wouldn't like it at first just because of the very nature of it, but I think he'd be extraordinarily proud by the time he finished it.
Did you toy at all with the idea of writing this, or was it clear for you that you wanted to do this?
I started taking notes, but not in a sort of pointed way about the burglary, which happened first. So, you know, the book kicks off with a burglary. And then exactly 1 month later, down to the hour, Russell dies. So it just became a much different story. So at first it was the dwarfing of the burglary, which I knew should actually not be dwarfed. It's a big deal what happened. And it's actually worth writing about. It's worth writing about in a thoughtful way, in a comical way. But, you know, Russell is not a footnote to the burglary. This is a human life, plus a dear friend and a tragic loss. So it instantly became something bigger. And I thought, I wonder if this could be a book about all kinds of loss, loss that doesn't quite fit, that could have tentacles, I suppose, that go out beyond myself and beyond Russell. And so the second I felt that, I didn't really have any doubt about writing about it. I mean, you're obviously writing about someone where I'm in a position where I'm the friend, right? Not the friend, it's the only friend. It's a very popular man, but you know, I'm not the partner. I'm not the husband. I'm not the mother. I'm not the sister, so forth and so forth. I'm not even the dog. And so, it's this sort of position where I just knew that my one rule for myself was not to speak for anything that I didn't, you know, to explore why I thought he died without conjecture.
I'm imagining that the structure probably really helped you write it, either when you started or when you were really getting into it. So I wanted to ask you about it. It's kind of the stages of grief is how you structured it, although you don't have acceptance in there. And I'm sure there's a reason.
And I swapped one. I can't remember even.
They're
I think it's
order.
Depression and anger. I mean, they're out of order in real life, but yeah, they're out of order in the book too.
Exactly. So was that evident to you that that was the structure you wanted to use?
That's a good question, which sounds like I'm filibustering like a politician. I'm so happy you asked that, ma'am. No, but I think it's actually the second stage, which is bargaining, that caused me to invite in what I would find to be an otherwise kind of eye-rolling kind of buttressing of the book. So I am not someone who gravitates towards dividing things like this. You're not going to find me writing a book where there are four seasons and those are the four chapters. Do you know? And yet what happened was with bargaining, the time that I felt that I was doing that from a grief perspective the most. Obviously, things go in and out. They're not in perfect order. Also was the time I was literally trying to get my jewelry back. And so it just fit. It locked in this way where I could almost like hear the click. And I thought, this is so ideal for what I'm doing. I don't know if it's perfect to the reader, but it was perfect for me, that there's no reason why the rest of the book can't follow these stages. And there are only so many of them. Do you know what I mean? So you've got 1/5 of it down right there. So I think that that's when the rest of the stages and the structure of it came in. But it started, it wasn't there at the very beginning until I realized that sort of emotional state overlapped with literally trying to get my jewelry back.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like structure nonfiction has more inherent structure than fiction because you're recounting real things that happened. It's not like all of a sudden you go to Mars and discover a new planet, you know, like in fiction, anything right. can happen. But it seems like giving containers around how you want to write something makes it so much more something that you can wrap your head around.
Totally. And it also makes it more interesting. I think I would actually go as far as to say, using your point, that because nonfiction, and it doesn't have to be narrative nonfiction, it could be biography, anything like that, is so pre-structured by time and space and physics, it's actually your job to make it interesting by messing it up, by going back and forth in time, by weaving threads, by sort of using elements like suspense or sort of, you know, elements that you normally would associate with fiction in order to get people back into what really happened to you. So otherwise you sound, you sound like a 5-year-old and then, you know, which is cute for a minute, but I don't know if you've ever been around a 5-year-old for 200 pages.
Yeah. And they're telling you a story about what they cooked for dinner. And then all of a sudden they're like, yeah. And I ride bus 5 to school. And you're like,
right, exactly. And you're like, can you weave this back into something? Is this foreshadowing? What is it? And they're just, and they're five. They won't answer. But but yeah, you know, it's sort of like you have to use these elements. And so the book is so loosely structured around these stages. Like you said, the last stage is afterward, because it's a book. It's not acceptance. It's afterward. It goes back and forth. I mean, the actual sort of hidden structure really of the book, but it's just not in any of the marketing materials, because I think I thought it was cheesy and FSG probably did as well, is that it takes place over the course of almost exactly a year. So, you know, but, you know, I would rather do just horrible things to my eyes and my nail beds before I wrote, you know, a book called My Year of Fill in the Blank. So, but the truth is, it is in fact almost exactly a year. It's June 2019 to June 2020.
In the very beginning, you're writing about these feelings that you have for him. You're talking about flea markets, which he loved, but you're also talking about like how much of a person's life do you put in? If you say too much, are you manipulating a reader, or are you making them more generic? And if you say too little, are you really representing them? And you say it's too much laundering of empathy. And what you're referring to is you're writing a book, maybe not that I miss this person, but miss this person as much as I do. So I wanted to just ask you about that sentiment and, you know, how you find that balance.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things, in the same way I constantly now have to remind myself that this book is not him and I am not this book. I also, while I was writing it, had to remind myself that I am not his biographer. It is not my job to explain, you know, he was born on a dark and stormy night and go from there. But I think the specificity balance is difficult, because there's something that's true. It's in nonfiction and fiction, it doesn't really matter, where something that shouldn't happen, the same way that bees apparently aren't supposed to fly. Bees have a short wingspan, and apparently if you look at them and you were to look at them not knowing what a bee was, you'd think, well, that's never taking off, but it does. And similarly, that, like, this is a strange analogy for it, but that specificity when you're describing someone is actually what reaches out to people and becomes universal, and becoming too vague does not. It does, you know, my friend was a nice person. Who cares? Do you know what I mean? Like, it's like you have to say something specific about them. But in terms of manipulating the reader, all literature is manipulating the reader. All literature, you know, you wake up and you do it. It's not, I mean, I am, the trick, hopefully, of this book is to make it seem like all of it just poured out of me in one go. Do you know, the trick is to make it look like I almost can't help myself but say certain things, because that's how it felt in the moment. But you are filtering that through the lens of actually writing. And so you do have a little more time with it to figure out exactly what you want people to feel and exactly what you want people to know, and just sort of average those out and get as close to the truth and what matters to you and to other people as possible.
I'm curious on a more maybe unanswerable question, but in the same way that you were sort of really getting granular and like digging down to how much you put about a person. And I think that your writing has this beautiful blend of storytelling and just your reflections on life, like your own maybe Sloan philosophy of how you see the world. And
oh, how frightening.
There's a point in there, it was probably like my favorite part of the book, when you were interviewing for the job. And you were like, went back for a second interview, and Russell said to you, it's like you got into Harvard and you want a tour of the bathrooms. So there's something about your brain that sees like this big picture, what's going on. And then you also, essays are so much about your personal perspective. So I'm just curious, how did you get that way? Like, what influences turned you into this person?
This is a beautiful way of asking sort of what's your damage. I think, you know, in terms of the humor, in terms of, two things. The broader thing for humor is it's sort of how you got attention and proved you were smart in my family. So I've always sort of been like this, which is funny, because if you ask other people that are known for that kind of writing, or even maybe in different art forms or formats like stand-up, if it's guys, it's usually to impress women or ward off bullies. If it's women, it's often to offer something else if they felt self-conscious about something that they weren't, that something traditional or cliche they didn't have. For me, it's just my family. but I think within that, those asides, it's just how I express myself. I mean, I always say that, you know, I read these beautiful lyrical novels, you know, sort of award-winning novels or either nonfiction, or if we're going to get closer to home with the topic of this conversation, I think of like The Year of Magical Thinking, or Megan O'Rourke's work. It is stunning and I love it. And I could never really do it because in place of this sort of beautiful lyrical imagery, I have these asides and these jokes and these analogies. And to me, they're beautiful. And that's how I sort of express myself. So the writing, when I talk about interviewing with Russell, it's just how I remember him. And I think, I don't know if this is really an answer to your question, but I think that when someone dies, you both immediately go through the greatest hits of your memories with them and how much you love them and how much they were there to bear witness to and how much you bore witness to in their lives. But then you also have these like aftershocks, or these almost like acid flashbacks of, oh God, right. So all it takes is telling a story about, okay, well, how did I get to know this man? He didn't just appear out of thin air. I interviewed with him. And then remembering that time that I did that incredibly bratty thing of, I mean, can you imagine asking someone for a second interview when they already offered you the job? I hope it's not indicative of my personality in general, but I absolutely did that. Yeah.
For me, though, too, it's more than humor. It's like a certain intelligence and way that you see the world that comes out that maybe you did do a lot of acid. I don't know.
It's a tremendous amount. I think that... I mean, that's nice. Maybe perhaps I'm being inadvertently self-deprecating by calling it humor and not intelligence, but I do think they're one in the same. I don't necessarily, like I said, I put a lot of stock in sort of lyricism, but I think earnestness is not intelligence. So I don't know. I just don't know how you could, maybe the intelligence part is the observation part and then seeing the ridiculousness of those observations is the humor. I don't really know. I don't mean to sound like, you know, flipping my hair back, like, oh, this whole thing, how did I do it? I don't know. I just sort of worked really hard and then pressed print.
Yeah.
It's a terrible answer.
Well, I just think some people might be born more observant. Sometimes they're Scorpios. Sometimes they did have like an amazing drug experience, you know?
I know. I only had terrible drug experiences. And I've given them so many chances. I can't tell you. Oh, I've been really generous to drugs and they've not been as generous to me back. So it's unfortunate.
Well, yeah, at least you can check that off the list. We'll be back with this interview in just a moment. Remember, you can listen to this and every episode without ads and without these pitches by becoming a patron of First Draft at patreon.com/firstdraftwriters. As you were going through this, you know, at points you say you went to a therapist. I think it was the therapist that said to you, how will you know you loved him unless you're destroying yourself? I love
that. Was actually a cardiologist.
It was so astute because I think annihilation in a way is to how we deal with grief. And I'm wondering if you can talk about, you know, how you, like you kind of had to experience it twice, right? You were experiencing it. I mean, I guess you were taking some notes while you were going through it, but it's like you, I don't know, all the things you were doing to just sort of make the pain go away. You were going out with a lot of people that you didn't really know very well.
No, I'm kidding. Yeah.
And then you had to write it again. So I just wanted to ask about this.
Yeah. Oof. Yeah. I don't know if it's connected to that line, which on a side note, maybe we can just sort of so button that up by saying something which is very true, which is especially, I think I'm just sort of used to a humor rating as well, where like just doctors have the best lines. They have the best lines. If you really want a kicker for something, you just go see a doctor about something, which is probably the most like neurotic Northeast thing I've ever said, but it's true. Yeah, I think in terms of dealing with it twice, It's about the timing of when you start writing something like this. You know, as much as I think of my book as a very special little snowflake and there's just nothing else like it, it's patently false. There's other books about grief, about loss of all kinds. I think it was Capote. I'm going to mess it up. But Capote had some line about how all your tears should be dry by the time you sit down to write. And I've always felt that's not totally correct, not to question Truman Capote. But I've always felt that they should be so recent. You should be puffy. There should be wet tissues. They should be crumpled and a little bit disgusting and on the nightstand. It should be close, because if it's too far away, I could never write this book now, ever. So part of the fuel of it is the madness of it, but you have to have enough of a handle on your own madness and your own grief in order to sort of be functional, to open up the laptop, to start typing. Do you know? I mean, just very basic things. But it was really hard. I cried a lot while I was writing this book. There were moments where I would hit, there are still lines that I read out loud. Like I said, I just recently recorded the audiobook that I could feel the snag of them, like turbulence. You know, I could feel it in my voice and just still being really shocked. You know, as much as denial is the first stage of the book, and I mention within that section that I'm sort of surprised, or it's around that section, sort of in the beginning of the second one, that I'm looking into the window of a restaurant where we ate together, and thinking, this is all a mistake. You know, surely he's in the bathroom. That's where he is. And he'll just appear at any moment. And he's been there for a while. Maybe he's having some stomach issues, but he's in the bathroom. You know, and it's just, and I still feel, one would think that after the experience of writing this book, that I'd have a better handle on the truth of it. And I think it's possible that I never got past stage one.
Do you feel like that emotional, like the right level of emotion that you had towards this when you wrote this is true for other things that you've written?
Yes, I do. I think most things I've written are like that. I think it doesn't go well if I wait too long, if I leave it sort of on the shelf and think, you know, the only way, at least my version of narrative nonfiction works well in terms of plucking something out. If someone were to assign me, oh, write about a time the color green meant a lot to you, you know, write about a time where you lost something in public or you found money. I don't know. I'm thinking of like random writing prompts. Then I can do it for a very short spurt of time. And usually I'm lucky in the fact that that spurt of time fits well in a magazine. Do you know, write about that kind of thing. But in terms of actually mining my life, I think part of actually weirdly an aversion I have to this being memoir is not an aversion to the practice of it or the category. It's not some sort of ghettoizing of memoir, but it is a feeling that I am not unqualified for that, that this is sort of memoir by accident. Because it does tell a story about my life and where I came from, and my sort of work history. And, you know, there's bits about my history in New York, the history of the, you know, the early aughts in New York, and they just sort of sneak in there. And then eventually they add up to the story of a time period, but I didn't do it intentionally or from the get-go rather.
One of the really eerie parts of the book was that you sort of had this running joke with Russell of saying to each other, like, no killing yourself without my approval. And it was something like you said to each other out loud, which you can see being said in jest. And I'm curious about that. And then maybe seeing something darker underneath later.
So I would not say we had a running joke about it, but he did at some point, a mutual friend of ours died by suicide. Actually, I couldn't believe it when I looked up the date for the book, just to look up the little notice of her death. It's like a year and 1 week before he died. I'm like, what is going on with this time period? There are a lot of eerie coincidences like that in the book. But I mentioned I forwarded him the piece about her, and he really jumped to, you know, death is so final, it's so sad. And he was the one who said, you know, let's make a deal, no killing yourself without my approval first. And he said, I'd be fair. And, you know, a lot of times, and one of the unanswered questions in the book comes not from me, but from other people, which is, did you know? Did you know? Were there signs? Can you, you know, dig up the tea leaves and reread them? And I think that for someone like this, no, because of something like that, like even it's not a running joke, but it is a joke he made, or not a joke, but a blasé way of speaking about it. For someone like that, you wouldn't send them to the hospital. You wouldn't say, if someone says, oh my God, I'd rather kill myself than go to Times Square, would I grab their arm and, you know, stroke it and say, should you talk to somebody? I don't think so. And I even give that example in the book, you know? And so he was like that. So yes, it's eerie and it's tempting to look into them and find meaning or some sort of a psychic connectivity. I think this is just how the world works. And it's terrible when it works this way, when it's working on death. But if it wasn't death, you'd find that delightful and it would be a great story. Do you know? Like, it's just sort of how it works. So Russell's saying, you know, oh, I think I'm going to, you know, I would kill myself, or this, you know, like Russell mentioning these things. I think if I took a sort of this is such a gross analogy, but like a suicide blacklight and ran it over the lives of everyone that you know and that I know for mentions of suicide, the thing would light up.
You know, that's what is so fascinating about the universe, though. And it happens in writing, you know, when you're paying attention, these things that you're writing about appear in the universe as gifts.
Yeah.
So they can be, I guess, gifts or something more like this, where it's just like eerily dark.
Yeah. And I think that it's just an incredible, there are moments like that in the book. You know, I was wearing the same sort of, you know, simple cotton dress that happened to be bright orange when I was burglarized, when I left for an hour and came back to find all my jewelry missing. And I was wearing it the last night I saw him. And I rolled it up and shoved it down a garbage chute because I decided the dress was damned. So as much as I feel like when I dig down, like all of this stuff is a coincidence, I'm not sort of above or exempt from a little bit of magical thinking.
Towards the end, you wrote about dreams that you had where yes. It just becomes much more dimensional because he's almost like alive again. But they're yes. New conversations. You're not like dreaming about old things he said. You're in your dreams, you're projecting how he would be now.
It did, because I think, you know, when I think about the book being framed for an audience, the consciousness that other people will read it, there are moments that do feel still like this sort of narrowing, this portal that's just between me and Russell, and I'm just intentionally letting people listen in. And most of the book is not like that, because then you veer into the danger of sort of either overly confessional or diary entry writing, where it's like, you know, you can come along this ride on this ride, reader. I don't care if you're here or not, which in fiction can work wonderfully. You get some of the, you know, best narrators that we've ever had with that kind of attitude, like Nabokov, Martin Amis, stuff like that. But I feel like in nonfiction, that consciousness, and you got to sing for your supper here and make your story entertaining. I really believe that, even if the entertainment is profound depression, you know, or people crying or people relating to it, that's a form of igniting somebody else. And so really with the dreams, and I say in the book, I should say also on this podcast, that I admit that it is a dirty trick to seed a story to a dream. So everyone should know they're not too long. But I can still picture them perfectly and vividly in my mind. And that is a little bit of me almost looking at the narrative through like splayed, you know, or spread fingers, and just sort of tossing this thing into the book, knowing it means a tremendous amount to me, knowing that I feel something sort of next level or magical in terms of my connectivity to Russell, and just hoping other people get it too. But I only do that towards the end of the book. It's funny. I hadn't really thought about it until just now, but, when I talk about, or the ends of each piece, you know, when I talk about, the dreams I had about him, or when I speak to him directly, because I feel like hopefully by then I've earned the consciousness that the reader is in the room for long enough that I can just sort of, it's almost like it's like, you know, two for you, one for me. That makes sense. You know, where I'm like, okay, this is something that I know we're all in this together. I'm explaining this to a reader. And then there are just moments where I feel like I'm alone with Russell that just happened to be in the book.
Do you think in the same way that we're talking about, like there's connections in the universe that sometimes you can see if you're really looking?
Yes.
That, I mean, you've structured this about, you had this you know, people came into your house, they broke into your house, you stole this, all this jewelry that was given to you by your grandmother, and then your friend died a month later. And obviously, like, in no way being callous, it was good for the writing. It like made sense for your writing. Sure. But do you look at it now and see any other links that make sense for you?
Oh, like mystery solving links, kind of? Like what happened?
No, but just like that was preparing you for something else. Like, I don't know.
I do see certain things. You know, I do talk just briefly in the book about how there's sort of that thinking often that's applied to sort of people who have PTSD, where, you know, you're sort of expecting trauma. Trauma is not a shock. You're in a constant state of knowing it's coming. And so my example in the book is, if you're a person who breaks a glass in the sink and then gets in a car accident later, but you never break glasses in the sink, that becomes momentous somehow to you. It becomes a harbinger of what's to come. But if you are a person who thinks of themselves or actually is the victim of like various disaster after disaster, and you break a glass in the sink and get in a car accident, it's, well, Tuesday. This is just your luck, you know? So I think a little, hopefully more the former, to blend analogies, a glass half full. But so I didn't really see, there's certain things that happened just before the burglary, not really Russell. Russell came out of the blue, but before the burglary, that were strange, that I don't think had anything to do directly with the burglary. There was a moment where I went to get coffee, or I went on an errand that was very brief, and I forgot to lock my door and came back. And it was about 2 days before the burglary. And I was sort of surprised that, you know, the key was not necessary. And the knob just turned. And no, the burglars, these people did not come in through my front door. And it was also one person. And it is also not, you know, it truly, there's also cameras in my apartment building. There's just like, it has nothing to do with anything. It's not like someone came in for 4 minutes to stake out my apartment, figure out like whether or not the windows would open and left. You know, this did not happen. And I know that for a myriad reasons, but I feel like the fact that it happened at all, that sort of looseness, is a good example of, I guess, what you're talking about. I mean, it's not in the book, but it is sort of strangeness. I mean, part of the reason it's not in the book is because all these kinds of things sound almost unbelievable when you try to nail them down by writing them down. And there's, you know, and so that's also the challenge of writing about grief, the challenge of writing about these two events, is how to articulate something that feels so amorphous and strange and just magical in the worst possible way.
How did you know when you were writing this that you were done? Because obviously this is an ongoing conversation with yourself in the world about what happened, and you're not going to be just like, okay, I'm better. So how did you feel like,
thanks for saying that. It's not actually, it's not intuitive for a lot of people. Okay, thank you for saying that. Just because I think people do confuse, as I say in the book, the written word with the final word a lot, and don't see it as this sort of evolving thing. But the real stage, I suppose, as opposed to the sort of artificial stages and the structure that I reached, was recognizing truly that I had to be on the side of the living, that I could keep Russell with me and not be so loyal to him above my own life, moving forward in it, how I treat other people, and just try to remember that this is painful, but this actually did not happen to me. This happened to my friend. And like, just that feeling of not wanting to go down with the ship anymore is really how the book, without spoiling it, sort of ends. And that seemed, it's hard to articulate it, but it seemed like a big moment for me in terms of my, I mean, you heard it here first and only grief journey. Maybe the last time. But, you know, in terms of my feeling, it just felt like, you know, it's sort of in the very end of the book, of facing a different direction.
And so sort of when you understood that yourself, you knew like you could let the book go, like that the book was going to be ready.
Yeah. And I think what's funny about it is, if you look at other grief memoirs, they're all, I don't know what this is. This is actually sort of something that I only noticed having done one of these things, they're all about the same length. The very few of them are more than like 250 pages. That would be a real shock. Most of them are little babies. Whether it's, I mean, Max Porter, that's a novel, but it's also a baby book. The grief, grief is a thing with feathers, I think. And then, you know, both of the Didion memoirs, Ann Patchett's Truth and Beauty. They're not that long. I think there must be something about what the mind can sort of sustain imaginatively about a person. I think maybe you just get exhausted by conjecture about that person and about what's going to happen to you. And then maybe you just have a sense that, well, I'm not going to drag the reader down with me and exhaust this person, this mythical person too. And it just sort of stops. And you just have to figure out in a sort of roulette wheel kind of way, what's the right place to stop. And for me, it was the sort of recognition that I could be as kind to people who were still here as I was to Russell and to myself as well.
We'll be back with this interview in just a moment. Remember, you can listen to this and every episode without ads and without these pitches by becoming a patron of First Draft at patreon.com/firstdraftwriters. Can you read something that by another author that influences you as a writer?
So I thought about this and, you know, the question was about a writer who influenced me. And that I found that so difficult because there are so many and I didn't know what to do. So I thought about a specific passage that influenced this specific book. And that is actually because a lot of the book, part of the questioning of it is about, you know, without being a craft book, about how the story is being told. Am I telling it correctly? What is a different angle on the story? How do we sort of break into it, if you'll pardon the pun? And I've realized that a lot of that and the tenses moving back and forth is very specifically from a short story by Russell Banks called Sarah Cole, A Type of Love Story. And I'll just read you a little bit. One night, several weeks later, Ron meets Sarah at Osgood's, and after buying her 3 white Russians and drinking 3 scotches himself, he takes her back to his apartment in his car for the sole purpose of making love to her. I'm still the man in this story, and Sarah is still the woman, but I'm telling it this way because what I have to tell you now confuses me, embarrasses me, and makes me sad, and consequently, I like to tell it falsely. I'm likely to cover the truth by making Sarah a better woman than she actually was, while making myself appear worse than I actually was or am. Or else I'll do the opposite, make Sarah worse than she was and me better. The truth is, I was pretty, extremely so, and she was not, extremely so, and I knew it, and she knew it. She walked out of the door of Osgood's determined to make love to a man much prettier than any she had ever seen up close before. And I walked out determined to make love to a woman much homelier than any I had made love to before. We were, in a sense, equals.
Tell me more about that.
That story I have read aloud to people multiple times against their will. but there's so much in that story where he goes back and forth between the third person, the second person, the first person, because he's trying to grapple with the guilt he feels about what eventually happens to his friend, to this woman he starts sleeping with, who, as you can tell from the passage I read, is on the surface very unattractive. And on the surface, he is just sort of, you know, a greyhound. And so it's this sort of push-pull between them and what happened and how they meet. And there even a moment that I stole that I actually didn't even read in that passage, where there's this blasé way where you can tell he's trying to rush through something painful. And he says, my friend Sarah, comma, who is dead now, and then keeps going. And that is exactly how I introduce Russell, which is funny because I just realized saying it right now. It's Russell Banks and Russell, my Russell. So maybe the world is more magic than I'm giving you credit for. but there's just something about that. I think you have to be really careful for it. I've always admired the skill of that story because it's so imitative, where like you can't have the reader watch you struggle. You know, is there imitative fallacy they tell you about in like creative writing 101? You know, you have a bored character, don't bore the reader. You have a character who's unconscious, you know, careful. And so, which is why, by the way, I've always felt, I know people have mixed opinions about it, but I really have always loved my year of rest and relaxation, because if anything else, I looked at this and I thought, this narrator is unconscious 90% of the time. That's a neat trick. So, you know, just in terms of structurally and how you do it. And I think this story is so beautiful. And I'm like, just thinking about the ending, if I think about it too hard, it'll make me cry. I think the ending of this is mind blowing. So I don't want to ruin it for anybody, but, it's connected to how he tells the story and his difficulty in his own sort of culpability in telling the story. And there's even a line in Grief is for People where I say something about that's more less of a steal and more just sort of abstractly influenced by the story, where I say something about how I'm hesitant to tell a certain part of it. And I say, frankly, it's because I might one day be compelled to read these words out loud. Which was a trip in the audiobook, but yes.
Can you read something you wrote? Maybe it was tricky or hard or changed a lot from the first draft or something you like?
Sure. This is a little more than halfway through Grief is for People. Eventually, you know, Russell sort of remains my North Star and the reader's North Star throughout the narrative, but eventually, it does sort of bleed into COVID because of the time period, but I wanted to go as fast as humanly possible and as impactfully as humanly possible through 11 years of tragedies in New York City in half a page. And so that was difficult. And so now I'll read it. September 2001, the downtown 9 train, a disturbance on the tracks. The subway rattled, moved backward, and released us into Times Square. I knew a girl from college who worked as a temp in the World Trade Center. She woke up that morning and decided to blow off work and sit in Central Park with a disc man, emerging around noon. I sometimes think of those bonus hours of innocence she smuggled with her into the new world. August 2003, a city unplugged. Computer monitors dark. We walked down flights of stairs until our knees hurt. That night, my neighbor, whose husband had been on the 104th floor of the North Tower, hosted a dinner by flashlight. For some reason, her dead husband's parents had granted a Canadian documentary crew permission to interview her about her loss. She opened the window and yelled at them to fuck off until they left. Then she lit a joint off a candle and said, "I hope they get stuck in the Lincoln Tunnel." October 2012, windows taped, air conditioning unit whistling, boyfriend in California. "I might hang up on you," I said, nothing personal. Suddenly, a horrific sound. The building around the corner was not up to code, and the entire facade collapsed into a pile of rubble, which turns out to be a fantastically noisy thing, a facade collapsing. My boyfriend suggested I get out of there. I felt around for a corkscrew, but where on earth would I go?
Do you want to say more about choosing that?
In a weird way, I think I wanted to keep COVID company, but without dwelling too much on the past and going forward in time as quickly as possible. That passage is a bridge for me explaining really the most sort of, I would say, memoiristic or biographical part of the book, of me explaining how I grew up. You know, and where I grew up, and in White Plains, and this sort of tribute to Grand Central, and this tribute to, you know, sort of Cheever's suburbia, which wasn't always so Cheevery. And then a bridge to COVID, and we go back to Russell, and we say, you know, it's just sort of the opening of that passage. And it was hard to do it as quickly as possible and as with impact and intention. So sometimes when you're rushing through something, it feels obviously unemotional. You need things a beat, but there's something about this where the sort of methodical nature of it and the run through is what's emotional about it. That every few years there's some sort of tragedy. And also what was difficult is I knew I had to land on that facade collapsing. I lived in Chelsea and a whole building just collapsed because it was so noisy. And then immediately there's a break. And then the next passage, which I did not read, says March 2020, the quiet, as if with a snap of the fingers. So you sort of start realizing, hopefully in retrospect, that that entire passage is building in sound, and then it stops.
Where do you write?
I write at my kitchen table, or I write in my bedroom and nowhere near a desk, which is much to the chagrin of chiropractors around the world.
What do you do, or where do you go to get away from writing?
I mean, mostly I don't. I walk. I do walk. That's what I do. But I don't have a place I go. If I have a place that I've sort of bent over backwards to, you know, leave the city, pay for transport, find a cat sitter, that's a place I'm going to get more work done, not less.
Who do you show your work to first to get feedback?
This is insane. I show it to my editor, which is just straight to the top. Yeah.
How have you dealt with rejection?
I mean, not well, but I think I sort of mentally seal off the opportunity and move forward. I mentally seal off that that was a thing that could have happened.
What is your favorite word?
Shampoo.
Thank you so much for this conversation. I'm so grateful.
Oh, it was lovely. Thank you. Your questions were wonderful.
If you like today's show with Sloane Crosley, author of the memoir Grief is for People, check out my interview with Lou Spinney, author of Beyond the High Blue Air, a memoir about her son's catastrophic snowboarding accident, her family's grief, and her legal journey to medically end his life. You can find that interview in the entire First Draft archive of more than 450 interviews at firstdraftwriters.com. You can stay tuned to First Draft on social media, on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Just look for First Draft ADOW. You can email me at firstdraftwriters@gmail.com anytime. Remember, there are plenty of extras for becoming a member and donating to First Draft, including access to pitch-free, ad-free content, as well as cuts from the interviews that didn't make it into the final show, writing tips from my guests, books, and more. Join me as I reach for honesty, vulnerability, connection, curiosity, and insights on craft with each episode. I can't tell you enough how much each and every single dollar counts to keeping this show alive. The first tier of support is just $6 a month, so please go to patreon.com/firstdraftwriters. Coming up in the next few months on First Draft, interviews with Tommy Orange, Deborah Spark, and Kylie Reed. I want to send out a huge thank you to my patrons for making this interview happen. Your support makes First Draft, a dialogue on writing, a reality every week. Please stay healthy and safe. The theme music for First Draft was produced and performed by Murph Mahaffey. I'm your host and producer, Mitzi Rapkin. Thank you for listening.